Welcome to Unfiltered Finance. I'm your host, Ron Geffner. By way of background, I started my career at the SEC. I've been working with private funds for the last 30 years and the securities markets. And this show is really to bring you some information that you might otherwise not have access to and let you know how the sausage is made. It's about time people learn more about it. So I'd like to welcome to the show Lloyd Collier. Lloyd is with JTC Group. He is a senior director. While I know JTC is a third-party administrator providing services to private funds, they provide a range of other services such as corporate, private client, and employer solutions. Welcome to the show, Lloyd.
Thanks, Ron. It's great to be here. And yes, let's talk about it.
And I'm excited to have you. One of the things that's impressive about your background is you spent over two decades on the sales side of the business, which gives you a very different perspective than other people who've only been in the third-party administration business. So why don't you give our guests a little bit of information about your background?
Sure. So I think many people who work in the world of PE, and when I say PE, I mean the broadest church of private assets, whether it's real estate or infrastructure or whatever it might be, private funds, is typically they've either grown up through the asset class and have found a way to monetize and develop their particular, you know, expertise, whether it be the wind farms, or they've grown up through the fund finance CFO route coming from an accounting background and have then found themselves within the middle office of the GP and have led that through their career. Where I've come from a slightly different perspective, where I grew up through the banks and the sales side and an asset servicing lens, where I've been working with collective investments since 1997, whether it's the good old-fashioned UCITS or the AIF regime from 2014. And then the last few years, I've really lent into private assets as an asset class. And so I'm coming at things from a different perspective. So I like to think that gives a bit of diversity to the value that I bring.
And to slow it down for some of our listeners, AIF means alternative investment funds. It's a common parlance in Europe. So quick question I hadn't really thought of until you sort of shared your background. What sort of surprises did you have when you transitioned from the sell side at the bank to third-party admin? There must have been some assumptions you had made that were proven incorrect or some unique life experiences that you hadn't really had until this time.
You know, the first thing that comes to mind there, Ron, is I worked at one of the big American firms where we talked about a collaborative business model and style and helping managers grow their funds and focus on their core thesis, which is, of course, finding great investments and looking after your investors. Basically, anything else is non-core. When you've come out of a firm that does everything into a firm that does a more specialized and unique set of services and products, and then you have to work with other firms to dovetail around what you can and you can't do. And so that's been really interesting to say, okay, we've got quite a narrow swim lane here. Let's do these couple of things really, really well, and then understand what our friends and competitors and peers are doing, where we neatly fill in the jigsaw for a mutual client.
You know, that's a really great point. And all the podcast interviews I've done, participated on as a guest, or where I've obviously been hosting, no one has yet brought in the concept of collaboration. And for many people who don't have experience in private funds or they're launching their first fund, collaborative effort among the third-party vendors is actually really important to the success of your business. Because I often will say to people on calls when I'm introducing third-party administrators or auditors, they become your issue spotters. And so you want them to sort of stay in their lane where they issue spot, but they realize it's not their core competency. And they might say, go back to your lawyer to check this because this might be an issue, or go back and speak with your auditor. And that collaborative effort really helps enhance a client's success or failure.
Yeah, totally agree. It's interesting. When I was at the asset servicing of the US firm, I was in a relationship role where I was looking after the relationships that we had with London-based fund manufacturers in the broadest sense of that word. Now the relationship that I'm managing, and I'm particularly responsible for Ireland, and I know we're going to come on to that a bit later, is the relationships that I'm managing are with the Irish law firms, with the Irish independent directors community, with the advisory firms, the tax and so forth, or sustainability, which is, you know, another a recurring theme where, again, you get to know these people and you work with them on engagement A and B. And guess what? You both kind of credentialize and look after each other. We bring people we like working with. That goes without saying. But beneath that, they have to be absolutely solid and be trustworthy because you make a recommendation or an introduction, you have your personal credibility on the line as part of what you've done. And so you end up building really strong relationships with people at firms where sometimes we compete and sometimes we collaborate. And that's an absolute pleasure to do so, particularly in Dublin.
Yeah, well, and so going through to that, it leads me to two questions. So let's focus on one. Given your experience, how does when somebody's consuming or purchasing third-party administrative services, for many people, I feel like they really don't know how to assess it. And it's who did I work with in the past without rhyme or reason as the theory, it ain't broken, don't fix it, when the reality is they don't really know if it's broken and whether it needs to be fixed. How would you advise people who are trying to select a third-party administrator? How do they go and figure it out? Because it's a really, there's several hundred administrators. So how does one really go about picking who's the right fit?
Interesting. So where we play particularly is relevant to spin-out GPs, people who've come out of a larger firm and are they going to do fund one? And so for them, it's a question of they know that they need a set of providers, whether it be if it's a hedge strategy, they need a trading partner as their first and foremost. So when you're in the hedge space, your trading partner then drives your fund administrator because you need the front office technology and the lean and the balance sheet and those things. In the private asset side, it's all about who you know. And so when Ron and Lloyd spring out of a big firm and say, we're going to do wind farm fund one or solar project one, we have to go to people we know. Apart from anything, when you look at the hurdles it takes in terms of minimum fees and setups and onboarding in the asset servicing world, well, and with the bank and with the law firms, we take our personal brand and reputation from what we did at the in our former career. We'll probably bring that to the table in terms of who do we know, who can help. Now, in practice, that's less likely to work because when you've come out of a massive firm with hundreds of billions of dollars of AUM, the people looking after you will have a follow the sun service model with teams in the Far East doing early morning capture and enrichment, then Eastern Europe, then Western Europe, across the Atlantic for the books closed. Where actually, what we probably want on Fund One is talking to people who are delivering the service in Luxembourg, in Ireland, in Cayman, which are higher cost centres to operate out of. But then when you've got some experience in front of the new manager or the new GP, the answer is but a phone call away rather than going through the junior associate to client services to escalation and taking a week to get back round.
So one of the experiences I've had with third-party administrators is assessing who's experienced in the strategy that you're employing, who might have this tolerance of it, depending on the strategy, right? Certain strategies have a risk to them, whether in the past it was crypto or cannabis or any other area. Is there any other advice you might give a person who's kicking the tires of the third-party administrator? Not just about their strategy. Obviously, it's a function of what they anticipate they're going to raise in assets, what's an economic fit, but like where are the services being provided from? I imagine, because now we live in a global community, whether the services are being provided in the jurisdiction that the person you're dealing with is sitting, what questions might you advise people to ask?
I guess a couple of points here. One sensible and one a little bit lighthearted. The sensible point is we like to think about what we're doing here as we are putting the bumpers up on both sides of the bowling lane. And so we're helping course correct the GP who might be brilliant at whatever their asset class is, but they don't know what they don't know about what happens in the murky depths of the engine room and the asset servicing piece. So I don't know. We had a new launch manager a little while ago who knew exactly how his performance fee was going to work. But what he didn't know was how to translate that into a fund accounting system's calculation process such that he could give his LPs in maths terms, what he'd agreed with them at the handshake. And so we sat down with him and worked that through them on the accounting platform and then helped him create the rich text version of that, which was what went into the LPA and the PPM. So that's what I talk about, sort of high touch, put the bumpers up service. It
But how
seems
would
to
they know that? Sorry to interrupt you. How would one know, though? Like when you're dealing the sales side, I imagine everybody probably sounds really simple when it comes down to what's price, where's the work being done? Those are the common questions. So how does one distinguish from one third-party administrator to the other to know that they're going to get that high touch? Because everybody says high touch.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think, part of what we all do is doesn't matter what we wear anymore. What matters is how we conduct ourselves and how we behave. And you just instantly get that feel from when you're working with somebody that these are the right guys.
Okay.
I don't think there can be any more scientific than that. I sort of say to my wife laughingly, my role is selling the proverbial ice to the proverbial Eskimo. The hard bit isn't selling the ice, it's finding the Eskimo. That's where the magic happens. Once somebody's signed with Fund Admin A or Depository Bank B, that's an 8 to 10 year commitment, because it doesn't matter how poor an experience you get, the pain of trying to disentangle that and move things, the life midlife of the fund is just incredibly painful. And so you need that little bit of luck to find your JTC or your whomever it is, while you know that there's a variety of providers, all of whom, as you say, yes, we do all the bells, and yes, you get the back rub at 4 o'clock, and we'll make a cup of tea for you. And then some often find that isn't the case in practice.
No, it's not. Well, we've all purchased services in the course of our lifetime that never matched up with what we expected it to be. And whether we were missold it or whether we misheard it, like meaning we heard what we wanted to hear, who knows?
Yeah,
So
that's go on.
going on to another subject, we talked about Ireland as a jurisdiction off air. What distinguishes Ireland as a jurisdiction from other jurisdictions in the marketplace?
Okay, a couple of things. So when you think about a London or a Dubai or a New York, those are the world's buying centers where the front office, the buy and the sell side come together and transact and deal and make the magic happen. Your Caymans, your Jerseys, your Luxembourgs, your islands are the service centers where, for tax and corporation and other reasons, the work is done. Ireland is unique on a couple of fronts. You can do a Cayman fund or a Jersey fund or a Luxembourg fund without ever setting foot in the jurisdiction, because the US and the London law firms have long established practices and premises and understand the local laws. So there's no need to actually talk to anyone on the ground. Because Ireland has the dual nuance or wrinkle of Irish law within the common law framework, one, and two, the ICAV, which is the only fund structure in the world that has the full US tax treaty with the what we call the tick the box, which is a sub fund or cell level ability to flex it. And because the Irish,
Meaning to be taxed as a partnership is what you mean by check the box.
yes.
Yes. Okay.
And so if you're a US manager and or with US investors or investments, particularly a liquid or a credit strategy, the ICAV is an incredibly powerful combination to tick all of, to fill all of those needs for you. But because the Irish legal and others are not competing on the world stage, so that anyone who's a Ropes and Gray or an Akin or somebody like that will then refer business into the Irish community. And so we get to actually speak to the people in Dublin. Once you've decided you want an Irish quaife rather than a Raith or a Cayman LP, you have to speak to someone here on the ground, which adds to that sense of collaboration that we talked to earlier. The other thing I'd say is it's a cultural thing, but we all know the story about meeting somebody Irish on holiday, or maybe a walking or a cycling trip where you get to spend time with the same people. By the end of the holiday, they're your friends for life. You're on your social media, you're getting Christmas cards. And that's because of the natural inquisitiveness of the Irish, because it's such a small territory. Everybody's 2 degrees of separation from each other. And so they want to know who you are and where you grew up and what your family did, because they're looking for those connections. That's exactly what the Irish are like to work with. And what that mean in practical terms, if you've got a wrinkle in a share class or a particular side letter or an interesting waterfall that falls outside of the normal process, the Irish will find a way to solve it for you.
And you're not being paid by the Irish community directly for this statement.
No. It's interesting. My last role, we worked everywhere, and so we didn't get to see the difference. In my current role, I'm responsible for Ireland. JTC's in all of those other territories that I met, where we do an excellent job, but it's really given me a fresh perspective on what a great place this is to do business.
No, I've had amazing experiences within Ireland, so I can't disagree with that. What are I know some of the strategies we've talked about, prior to this interview, carbon credits, defense tech, and clean cooling. Let's focus on defense tech, given what's going on in the world with the conflict between the Ukraine and Russia, between Israel, Iran, and the United States. On the closed-end fund side, private equity, venture cap, more VC, we're seeing the same curiosity or purpose with regard to defense tech. So why don't you share what you're seeing in the marketplace there?
Sure. And listen, when we talk about alternative assets, if you come right back to a 101 run, an alternative asset is something whose performance is not correlated to the stock market, right? You want a
Correct.
straight line of something, whether it be healthcare royalties, an aging population, buy more drugs. There's your straight line. In this case, we've got the world macro situation, the US withdrawing from, or at least threatening to withdraw from, being so active in European defence, which means that all the EU state defence budgets have significantly been enhanced and increased. And so there's your straight line, increased spending on defence. And so we're working with a new entrant GP who've got a couple of very well-known principals from that political world within the EU state nations. And they're looking at investing in things like underwater surveillance cameras, drone technologies, things like that. Non-offensive anything, but startup tech firms, deep tech that are in that space. And so when you then sort of think about that, and then you look at, I don't know, some of the headlines, I think it was JP Morgan recently who removed their or who included defense firms within their ETFs and their Article 9 products. It's what 10 years ago or 20 years ago would have been unthinkable as an investment class is now. It's part of it's part of a diversified portfolio. It has to be.
And why don't you elaborate on what you're seeing with regard to carbon credits or clean cooling as well?
Sure. So we've got a couple of managers we're working with who are doing Article 9 funds. So that's the deep green, Save the World SFDR categorization, one of whom's rewilding rainforest in APAC. So that's a positive credit generation. They're working with Rubicon to make sure that they've got all the credits correctly ready to be assessed and rated before they manufacture them. And so that's actively obviously removing CO2 from the world. We've got another manager that we're working with who is decarbonizing coolants, and it's nasty stuff called PFAS, which are the forever chemicals that go into things like your Teflon frying pan or your impermeable rain mac. If you're a cyclist, those things eventually get into the water course and end up in our tummies, where guess what? They're forever chemicals, they don't break down. And so these guys are replacing PFAS and other nasty coolants with nice clean versions. And guess what? There's this amazing stuff called H2O that's really good at keeping things cool when you pump it around. So, I get home from work and say to my wife, I've helped make the world a better place today, and my tiny little bit of value in the value chain there. But yeah, it's a
I'd like to think every day I help make the world a better place as well. What mistakes do you commonly see among managers, either launching Fund One or subsequent to Fund One?
Fund One, I think the biggest challenge that they face and that they don't realize is just how hard it is to get to your first close. You have that sort of two or three problems is, yes, you might have a 20-year track record behind you, but that was when you had your prior firm's email address and domain. And so often you'll find that you might find two or three cornerstone investors who are ready to write you a check to 50 to 100 million bucks, but they don't want to own 100% of the fund or be a controlling partner. And so that leaves you with that really difficult challenge of trying to herd three sheep into the pen for shearing at the same time, while they're all sort of looking at not looking at each other, but saying, I don't want to go first. And I think it's really, really difficult, really, really important not to underestimate the difficulty of doing that. I saw something on Preqin recently. The first time fundraising periods have stretched out to as long as 22 months over the last few years. So you've got to be busy. You've got to have you've got to have a compelling story and a great USP, and you've got to find LPs who will agree with your philosophy of what it is you're trying to accomplish. But you also need an awful lot of shoe leather wearing and a bit of luck. And people, I think, may downplay in their minds the magnitude of making that happen.
Yeah, that you raise a really excellent point. One of my friends in the industry who has no memory of saying this, but I've quoted him nonetheless, he was saying that, and this really, he applied it more to open-end funds, hedge funds, was you need 7 years of runway to really attract enough assets and stabilize. And when you look at the data that it takes 22 months to get to first close, having that long runway is, to me, really important. What I found is, though, then that affects some of your all your other decisions, right? If we work backwards from there, because we're starting to receive phone calls from people who've used firms that charge multiples more than we do, and they've raised half a billion or more or less, and now they need to switch vendors because they price themselves out of the ability to sustain their business. Meaning that's the net effect of what we're seeing with, I guess, a lack of awareness of the costs associated, the timing associated with running and launching these businesses, the impact. So, like, how are you seeing that impact play out? Where we understand it takes longer to get to first close, but how are you seeing it manifest with whether they're your clients or people in the industry?
It's an eternal challenge because the Lloyd and Ron that span out of big firm, we know about wind farms. We don't know about running an investment management business, right? We have a very specific area of expertise. And so we don't always understand what our recurring legal and advisory fees will be, how much the asset servicing firm needs us to raise in order to get beyond those minimum fee hard decks to be on a sort of number of basis points for the all-in service bundle. We know what our carry is and we know what our IRR and our hurdles are because that's our bread and butter. But bringing somebody into the firm early on as the COO, CFO, who's actually grown up through that route, it can't overstate how critical that is. But you've then got the challenge that you're in the early days, you're doing half of this off the side of your desk while you're talking to prospect investors. The last thing you need is a heavy salary on your books for that experienced person.
So that goes to another point. A lot of times we're seeing mistakes with, we'll call it the key principal, who really, I don't want to say doesn't appear to have the experience, but they've made mistakes in internalizing their team around them, where they haven't been good at negotiating and they're overly generous or the other way. And sustaining that team isn't realistic, which then has the knock-on effect of you're modifying your documents because somebody left. Or the agreements, or you're now focused on an internal battle versus external battles with the marketplace. Are you seeing that play out in any way as well with like team one or team two?
I think you make an interesting point in terms of people and their price sensitivity and how hard they negotiate, right? If you really squeeze everyone that you're working with on fees, you end up with them dragging their feet because they feel like you've nickel and dimed them, and then why would we want to work with you or do suddenly spin on a dime for you when you've had a late change in things, right? We're all doing this to make money. We're not here because it's a charity. It's nice to make the world a better place, but we do all need to pay off our mortgages or put our kids through college or whatever it might be. And so if you drive too hard a bargain, you end up creating resentment. And if you're too generous, then whatever your initial pot is that you're trying to build this business with, and you need as much of that as possible in the strategy to get it up and going. You've come out somewhere with a chunk of change in your back pocket. You want to put as much of that into your AUM rather than spending it on glossy offices and shiny websites and overpaid too many staff.
And I was more focused on the staff, partners either by name or real role to staff. And I've seen it go all over the place where there's no stability within the organization of their team, internal team, not external team. So how have you seen that play out in the last couple of years of your life?
So I think, who'd heard of the term fractional CFO, GC,
It's
whatever,
one of the
5 years ago?
hottest things. You can't shake a stick now with a
No.
fractionalized C-suite offering everywhere.
And it makes great sense, right? You don't need somebody for 40 or 50 hours a week. And so these firms or these individuals that are doing that, I think they're a great value add. You can pay them by the hour or contract them a number of weeks per whatever it is that you need them to do. You've got somebody with deep experience in exactly what you need. And then you know that you've only got them for the 3, 6, 12 months of whatever your commitment is. And then you can roll that on and amend it. And I'm a great fan.
Hey, by the way, as I'm seeing it, the market currently seems to be dictating an outsourced COO is about $150,000 a year. That's what I've been seeing in price points from some of the firms that have reached out to us or that we know our clients are working with. But so the okay, so for using outsourced fractionalized services, is there ever a point in time where you would recommend to your clients to internalize those? And if so, when?
So for me, the sweet spot for a new fund is 250 million. At that point, you're paying somebody like us 8 to 10 bips for the bundle of services. You're past the minimum fees. What you're earning yourselves. That's kind of the point at which your scale really starts to kick off. Now, at 250, you're still a minnow, obviously, but that's the point at which you've actually got enough revenue coming in from your investment management and other fees that you then really say, okay, we now have a full-time team. We now have a fully stocked office rather than a supported office, etc.
And then, what trends are you seeing with regard to what's going on in the admin business? Because obviously, we work with a bunch of administrators that have gone through aggregation. What are the challenges on the admin side that investment managers should be aware of?
So you've absolutely nailed it. We are all, JTC is currently FTSE listed, but we're being taken private as I speak by Permira with the deal due to close in the end of the year. The reason PE firms have got involved is because when this is done correctly, it's decent margin business with sticky customers. Once they've signed for those 7 years, as we said, you're then done, and you have a great opportunity to bring in other products and services or regions and really grow the relationship over a period of years. And that makes us a great target for PE firms. The challenge comes with that is then how do they build scale? Do they bolt on and acquire and add bits? And if they do that and the management team are incentivized and pressurized to hit the growth targets, it can be easy to look at how do we do this with fewer heads, do more with less. Fine, that's the way of the world. But if you don't invest in the technology to deliver the workflow amelioration to offset the number of bodies that you've got, and management are focused on building those acquisitions and bringing them in, that can then result in challenging service levels for the clients of the firm, which then results in, of course, footfall outdoors. It's a constant challenge.
So that leads me, based on my experience and as I'm hearing you and thoughts about what's going on with third-party administrators, I personally think there's too much weight being given to AI. And while it will create certain efficiencies, it doesn't create a heaven of complete efficiencies. And thus, my concern with when people are trying to better understand the implication of AI is their expectations are not realistic. Whether it's a PE firm going into a third-party administrator, whether it's a prospective client who wants to understand how you're using AI and how that'll affect their fees. Because from what I'm seeing, when I have prospective clients or clients coming to us using AI, it's actually increasing the work we need to do because it's not 100% on point.
So, a couple of thoughts there. First is that a lot of these firms, like my own, are using accounting and general ledger and other technologies that are 20 years old and more at their core functionality and heart. And so we might all have built a window to the world that has a nice some APIs and a nice web version to it, and potentially even hooked it into a data lake or similar so that GP can come in every however many milliseconds they want and pull whatever information it is. But at its heart, these are dot matrix processing systems. And so introducing AI as a bot, basically, in this sense, taking data out of the loan administration system and putting it into the fund administration system, or putting it from there into the cap call mechanism to go out the TA or the investor servicing system. Those are workflow enhancements or bots between them, and these are aged systems, don't sit well with understanding what's happening. And so you're right, it's a great term for what's going on and changing in the world, but in practice, where you're moving financial digits widgets through these old systems, I agree, there is no easy answer.
And one of the other final thoughts that I'm having is, are you seeing any effect on tokenization, either in the conversations? And what I would also preface it was with is there's a lot of misunderstanding about what tokenization will yield to fund managers. The biggest misnomer being, if I tokenize my fund, more people are going to want to invest. When the reality is, that's not the reality. There's no secondary market for tokenization to some greater degree as of yet. All right, is that part of your conversations with clients or prospective clients? And
So
if so,
a
how?
couple of thoughts, right? If we move the dial forward 20 years and everybody has access to DLT, and what tokenization could do in private assets funds is create secondary market or create liquidity for LPX that wants to pull out for somebody else to take their place, right? But in practice, in today's world, you see it yourself, these funds have 20 to 50 investors. Their quarterly liquidity or even annual, I don't see the benefit at all. You also have the issue that if the TAs or the fund administrators build tokenization, potentially they are vote the proverbial turkeys for voting for Christmas. Where I do see it working and is live now and makes perfect sense is if you think about a hedge fund moving margin to and from with their trading counterparties with the uncleared margin rules. If you're using something like a UCITS money fund, one of the Irish QMMFs in the middle, which is a secure way to instantly securitize cash, at the moment you come in the morning and you look at your mark to market, you post a collateral entry into or out of the money fund account held at the unencumbered custodian. What tokenization enables you to do is move to the market in real time throughout the day. As your positions swing in or out of the money, you can make sure that you haven't got any assets held to the PB's order more than is absolutely necessary. So there's a great real-world example of where tokenization adds something and is available now.
But that's tokenization of the assets for the portfolio, which I agree creates greater efficiency. But now, what about tokenization of the limited partnership interest or whatever the shares are, depending on how the vehicle is structured for investors?
I just don't see the benefit. I was on a panel in Frankfurt recently, and one of the subjects that came up was tokenizing ETFs. And I sort of looked at them and said, "Well, why would you need to tokenize something that Lloyd and Ron can already buy on our smartphone that is valued daily, and we have ultimate liquidity? What does that add?" On the private fund side, back to the point, there's only so many investors. Finding your LPs is your challenge, not necessarily finding secondary liquidity between them.
No,
These are.
I wholeheartedly agree. Like most other things in life, these are yet some of the things that I find are overblown and don't really fit most situations. And any other thing that you think that's worth discussing, based on your recent experiences?
No, I think, based on the sort of pre-chats we've had and just having a bit of a philosophical debate about the state of the world and private assets, I think we're in a healthy place. Private capital is able to reach parts of the world, either physically or geographically or just from an emotional spend that public finance can't. I guess one final closing point of thinking about AI. And this is something that I'm working through in my mind. I'm not sure how morally at peace I am with it, but those large language models and AI that we're all now using on our phones and everywhere else require a huge amount of computing power, which requires huge data centers building, which are hugely expensive to do, and they need an awful lot of cooling, which burns more carbon.
But
Now,
that
for
goes back to your clean cooling
yeah.
strategy and your carbon credit. It's a
I
full
know.
circle.
Well, yeah, but if we could put the data centers in some Norwegian fjords, that would solve the problem of the cooling. But there's no infrastructure there, and there's not enough high-speed ISDN lines and power there to either be able to make them or to operate them. And so, that's one that I am concerned about the future of the world.
Well, it sounds like you might have created your own investment thesis for your own personal fund to
There
manage.
you go. I'll go and find a way to monetize my network.
Well, I really appreciate having you on with us today, Lloyd. You're thoughts are invaluable, and I really enjoyed our conversations.
As have I, Ron. Thank you very much for inviting me on. It's been an absolute pleasure.